The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. Our first article was published by the Associated Press on the 20th of November, written by Nicole Winfield and Tricia Thomas, and entitled Trans Women Welcome Pope's Message on Day of the Poor. Torvianica, Italy. Pope Francis' recent gesture of welcome for transgender Catholics has resonated strongly in this working-class seaside town south of Rome, where a community of trans women has found help and hope through a remarkable relationship with the pontiff, forged during the darkest times of the pandemic. Thanks to the local parish priest, these women now make monthly visits to Francis' Wednesday general audiences, where they are given VIP seats. On any given day, they receive handouts of medicine, cash, and shampoo. When COVID-19 struck, the Vatican bussed them into its health facility so they could be vaccinated ahead of most Italians. On Sunday, the women, many of whom are Latin American migrants and work as prostitutes, joined over 1,000 other poor and homeless people in the Vatican Auditorium as Francis guests for lunch to mark the Catholic Church's World Day of the Poor. For the marginalized trans community of Torvianica, it was just the latest gesture of inclusion from a pope who has made reaching out to the LGBTQ+ community a hallmark of his papacy in word and deed. Before the church was closed to us, they didn't see us as normal people. They saw us as the devil, said Andrea Paolo Torres Lopez, a Colombian transgender woman known as Consuela. Then Pope Francis arrived and the doors of the church opened for us. Francis' latest initiative was a document from the Vatican's Doctrine Office asserting that, under some circumstances, transgender people can be baptized and can serve as godparents and witnesses in weddings. It followed another recent statement from the Pope himself that suggested same-sex couples could receive church blessing. In both cases, the new pronouncements reversed the absolute bans on transgender people serving as godparents issued by the Vatican Doctrine Office in 2015 and on same-sex blessings announced in 2021. Prominent LGBTQ+ organizations have welcomed Francis' message of inclusivity, given gay and transgender people have long felt ostracized and discriminated against by a church that officially teaches that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. Starting from his famous "Who am I to judge?" comment in 2013 about a purportedly gay priest, to his assertion in January that being homosexual is not a crime, Francis has evolved his position to increasingly make clear that everyone is a child of God, is loved by God, and welcome in the church. That judgment-free position is not necessarily shared by the rest of the Catholic Church. The recent Vatican gathering of bishops and laypeople, known as a synod, backed off language explicitly calling for welcoming LGBTQ+ Catholics. Conservative Catholics, including cardinals, have strongly questioned his approach. After his latest statement about trans participation in church sacraments, GLAAD and Dignity USA said Francis' tone of inclusion would send a message to political and cultural leaders to end their persecution, exclusion, and discrimination against transgender people. In Torvianica, Carla Segovia, a 46-year-old Argentine sex worker, said for transgender women like herself, being a godparent is the closest thing she will ever get to having a child of her own. She said that the new norms made her feel more comfortable about maybe one day returning fully to the faith that she was baptized in, but fell away from after coming out as trans. This norm from Pope Francis brings me closer to finding that absolute serenity, she said, which she feels is necessary to be fully reconciled with the faith. Claudia Vittoria Salas, a 55-year-old transgender tailor and house cleaner, said she had already served as a godparent to three of her nieces and nephews back home in Jujuy in northern Argentina. She choked up as she recalled that her earnings from her former work as a prostitute put her godchildren through school. Being a godparent is a big responsibility. It's taking the place of the mother or father. It's not a game, she said as her voice broke. You have to choose the right people who will be responsible and capable when the parents aren't around, to send the kids to school and provide them with food and clothes. Frances' unusual friendship with the Torvianica trans community began during Italy's strict COVID-19 lockdown, when one, then two, and then more sex workers showed up at the Reverend Andrea Conaccia's church on the main piazza of town, asking for food because they had lost all sources of income. Over time, Conaccia got to know the women, and as the pandemic and economic hardships continued, he encouraged them to write to Francis to ask for what they needed. One night, they sat around a table and composed their letters. The pages of the letters of the first four were bathed in tears, he recalled. Why? Because they told me, Father, I'm ashamed. I can't tell the Pope what I've done, how I've lived. But they did, and the first assistance arrived from the Pope's chief almsgiver, who then accompanied the women for their COVID-19 vaccines a year later. At the time of the pandemic, many of the women weren't legally allowed to live in Italy and had no access to the vaccine. Eventually, Francis asked to meet them. Salas was among those who received the jab at the Vatican and then joined a group from Torvianica to thank Francis at his general audience on April 27, 2022. She brought the Argentine Pope a platter of homemade chicken empanadas, a traditional comfort food from their shared homeland. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on November the 17th, written by Fiona Andre, and entitled American Evangelicals Interpret Israel-Hamas War as a Prelude to End Times. The end times are not a topic Robert Jeffress needs much prompting to talk about, but when war broke out between Israel and Hamas on October 7, the senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Dallas, and a national figure among American evangelicals, quickly prepared a sermon series on the apocalypse, which would be accompanied by a forthcoming book on the subject. On November 5, as the last notes of Redemption Draweth Nigh, a hymn about Jesus' return, resonated in First Baptist's 3,000-seat sanctuary, Jeffress asked his audience, "Are we actually living in what the Bible calls the end times?" The war in Gaza is not the only sign Jeffress submitted as evidence that the period presaging Jesus' second coming, detailed in the Bible's book of Revelation and other scriptures, is coming closer. He noted, too, rising crime rates, the proliferation of nuclear weapons and natural disasters, before announcing, "We are on the verge of the beginning of the end times." Things are falling into place for this great world battle, fought by the superpowers of the world, as the Bible said. They will be armed with nuclear weapons, he said. Other prominent evangelicals have taken up the theme in their sermons. The day following Hamas' attack, in which Israeli cities were barraged and some 1,200 people were massacred, Greg Laurie, senior pastor at the Harvest Riverside Fellowship in California, framed the violence in terms of end times prophecy. The Bible tells us in the end times that Israel will be scattered and regathered, Laurie said. The Bible predicted hundreds of thousands of years ago that a large force from the north of Israel will attack her after she, Israel, was regathered and one of the allies with modern Russia or Magog will be Iran or Persia. Before calling the church to pray for peace in Jerusalem, Laurie added, if you get up in the morning and read this headline, Russia attacks Israel, fasten your seatbelt, because you're seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled in your lifetime. While apocalyptic theology is threaded throughout the Bible and came to America with the Puritans, end-time prophecy has gone through cycles of popular acceptance among Christians. It has different strands, but its most widely known version, known as dispensationalism, Israel is a linchpin to the events of the last days, when, after the rapture, a coterie of 144,000 Jews are to be converted to Christ before eternity begins. Evangelical Christian pastors such as Jeffress have long prompted the United States to be an actor in these events. In his second sermon in the End Times series on November 12, Jeffress quoted the speech he gave at the ceremony dedicating the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem in 2018. For America to be on the right side of Israel is the same as being on the right side of history and the right side of God. The embassy's move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was the fulfillment of a promise Donald Trump made in 2016 as he ran for president for the first time, one applauded by pro-Israel evangelicals. In August 2020, as he ran for re-election, then-President Trump told a campaign rally in Wisconsin, "We move the capital of Israel to Jerusalem. That's for the evangelicals." Also present the day Jeffers spoke in Jerusalem was the televangelist John Hagee, who in 2016 founded Christians United for Israel, now the largest pro-Israel organization in the U.S. On October 22, CUFI hosted a Night to Honor Israel rally at Hagee's Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, with Israeli public figures on hand, as well as U.S. Senators Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton. Hagee was also a speaker at the giant pro-Israel rally held on November 14 in Washington, where he reaffirmed his commitment to Israel. "There's only one nation whose flag will fly over the ancient walls of the sacred city of Jerusalem. That nation is Israel, now and forever," he said, greeted by cheers. Claiming some 10 million members, Hagee's organization has become powerful politically, according to David Hummel, author of Covenant Brothers, Evangelicals, Jews, and U.S.-Israeli Relations. It is quite a large group, but it's even more significant that they are organized and have demonstrated over the years that they can actually focus their energy on a local level and a national level to advocate their position, said Hummel. The group's gatherings have become an obligatory stop for GOP presidential hopefuls wishing to articulate their support for Israel in front of Christian Zionists. "Most of them don't get into the prophecy stuff," said Hummel. "They'll talk more about the national interest that the U.S. has in supporting Israel and about the cultural values that Israel and the U.S. share. But Hagee often speaks about the prophecies that drive his support for Israel." A week after Hamas attacks, Hagee's Sunday sermon detailed the unfolding of the end times, while a timeline illustrating every step from Jesus' resurrection to the renovation of earth by fire was displayed in the background. "The recent Hamas attacks draws closer to the church's rapture," he claimed. "The Bible blessed the Jewish people directly, and through the Jewish people blesses us, the Gentile people," he said, before adding, "Israel is God's prophetic clock. When the Jewish people are in Israel, the clock is running. When the Jewish people are out of Israel, the clock stops," he said. This logic scandalizes some scholars, as well as Jews, who see evangelical support for Israel as compromised by its cosmic hope for their conversion. They, Christian Zionists, believe a tiny minority of living Jews will, in the end times, convert to Christianity, and the rest will be damned to hell for their disbelief, wrote Stephen Gardner, research director at the Political Research Associates, in a 2020 essay titled End Times Antisemitism. In a 2005 sermon, Hagee himself claimed God sent Adolf Hitler to perpetuate the Holocaust to push European Jews toward Israel. He later made clear he didn't view either Hitler or the Holocaust as positive. But end times theology need not be raw to come across as insensitive to the violence suffered by both sides in the long-running Israeli-Palestinian conflict. On November 12, Jeffress began his sermon by asking the congregation if they knew what could explain the numerous attacks against Israel. Spiritual reasons, he said. Our next article from the Religion News Service was published on November 15, written by Adele M. Banks, and entitled, Bishop T.D. Jakes Helps Launch Online Hub to Aid Faith Leaders with Mental Health Tools. Bishop T.D. Jakes has joined mental health and faith experts to launch a new curriculum to help clergy and lay leaders move beyond sayings like, I'm too blessed to be stressed. Such expressions may hide the strains and more serious mental health problems facing some people of faith, including congregational leaders, said the senior pastor of Dallas, the Potter's House, and the chairman of the T.D. Jakes Foundation. We have these colloquialisms that don't really allow help to come in, said Jakes, kicking off a 90-minute online forum on November 14. But tonight, we're taking off the mask. The forum introduced the Faith and Mental Health Hub, a free online course that includes more than a dozen videos that aim to define mental health, reduce stigma, and encourage self-care. It includes segments focused particularly on Black and Latino leaders, as research has shown that African-American and Hispanic adults with mental illness are far less likely to have used mental health services than their white counterparts, according to data from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. The course, some of which is offered in Spanish as well as English, also includes a compassion and refer section to help clergy shift from personally handling some regular forms of assistance, such as premarital counseling, to recommending someone with professional expertise, especially in an acute mental health situation. The Mental Health e-Learning Hub is funded by the Ad Council and the University of Utah's Huntsman Mental Health Institute, as part of a multi-year mental health initiative that includes the Love Your Mind campaign that began in October. It is supported by Jakes Foundation, leaders of several historically Black denominations, and other faith networks, including the National Latino Evangelical Coalition and the National African American Clergy Network. Overall, a 2023 Ipsos study showed that more than half of Americans, 58%, said they felt stressed to the point that it affected how they lived their daily life. A similar, but slightly lower percentage, 53%, said they felt so stressed they could not cope or deal with things. There's so many leaders in our faith communities who are trying to be a resource for everyone else, said Joshua Dubois, founding partner and CEO of Values Partnerships, which helped organize the video-based curriculum. But frequently, their own mental health gets overlooked. In an interview, he said his organization and the Ad Council held listening sessions that helped them develop the course. They realized that even as faith leaders sought to provide some congregants with needed mental health assistance, those in key positions, pastors, head ushers, choir directors, youth pastors, were often the last ones to get the resources that they need when it comes to mental health. Some recall the toll of the increased number of deaths of congregants during the pandemic. Others spoke of personal issues such as divorce. Speakers at the forum said it is important for faith leaders to have confidants, friends, and sometimes professional counselors with whom they can talk. The worst kind of loneliness is to be surrounded by people with whom you cannot speak, said Jakes during the forum. Added the Reverend Dante Quick, senior pastor of First Baptist Church of Lincoln Gardens in Somerset, New Jersey, we have to begin to think of ourselves not just as men and women of God, but as creatures needing the aid of each other. So for me, God aids me through a good therapist. Through the focus of the forum and the curriculum is on steps clergy and lay leaders can make toward improved mental health, psychology professor Regina Miranda said congregations in turn can aid their pastors in taking on some of the pastoral responsibilities. What can churches do to lighten that load and so that it's spread out more evenly? Asked Miranda, who teaches at Hunter College in New York City. Mental health is something that can be supported by things that we do, but also that our communities do to help support us as well. The new online curriculum follows earlier in initiatives that are fee-based or that focus on how congregations or faith leaders can address mental illness rather than how faith leaders can handle their own mental health. American Psychological Association President Thema Bryant, who also is an ordained African Methodist Episcopal minister, told RNS that the hub will be accessible and culturally and spiritually sensitive at a time when there's a great need for it. More than 1 in 5 U.S. adults are estimated to live with mental illness, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, a part of the National Institutes of Health. This web-based hub will be a valuable tool for all types of spiritual leaders by helping them become more effective counselors to the communities they serve and giving them information to support their own mental health, she said. As our nation continues to grapple with a mental health crisis, spiritual leaders are increasingly being called on to help many of us contend with anxiety, depression, and the myriad of stressors that are part of our everyday lives. Our last article was published by RNS on November 16, written by David I. Klein. UK archaeologists use metal-detecting hobbyist finds to study medieval faith. Much has been written about religious life in the medieval era, but thanks to the British fancy for metal detectors, archaeologists are hopeful about gauging just how much more has gone unwritten. Earlier this month, the University of Reading announced that it has been awarded £1 million by the British Arts and Humanities Research Council to study the role of religion in medieval life, for which the university will employ a unique source of data, the findings of hobby metal detectors that have been logged in the British Museum's Portable Antiquities Scheme. The museum scheme was founded more than 20 years ago, in part to quell archaeologists' fears that hobby metal detector users were disturbing the historical record. At the time, there was this boom in metal detecting, with lots of archaeological findings being discovered, and not really any mechanism to record them at all, Michael Lewis, the scheme's director, told RNS. So the Portable Antiquities Scheme was set up to provide a mechanism, on a voluntary basis, to record all the other sorts of discoveries that have been found. Since then, metal detecting hobbyists in Britain have had more than a few minutes of fame, thanks to a BBC show, Detectorists, that debuted in 2014. Detectorists wasn't their only time in the limelight. Three shows about the hobby, specifically in Britain, made it onto Detect History's list of its 10 best metal detecting TV shows. Though archaeologists once worried that the fad would hamper their work, They are now seeing it as another way to further understand the past. The reason that we're interested in this is that sources of archaeological evidence are increasingly showing us that quite a lot went on in the medieval period that wasn't recorded in historical documents, said Roberta Gilchrist, who leads the program at University of Reading. What we know about religion is through the lens of written sources, largely through the church and through the male priesthood, Gilchrist explained. We hope we're going to be able to use archaeological evidence to get more from the people who didn't leave documents. For example, women, children, or ordinary, everyday men. Through this scheme, metal detectors can log their finds with the museum, including the exact coordinates and conditions of where they were found. Some then choose to donate the artifacts, others keep them in private collections. So far, it has resulted in a database of more than 1.5 million entries, several hundred thousand of which date to the late medieval period. What we're particularly looking at is material culture that's associated with medieval pilgrimage, Gilchrist said, especially pilgrim badges that were produced as souvenirs for Christian shrines at the time, as well as metal ampulla that were used to hold holy water. These were really just very cheap objects made of like a lead-tin alloy. But there are thousands of these things, said Gilchrist, and we can map them because the metal detectors now, when they find them, they all have GPS on their phones, and they can give you a very accurate indication of where they find these things. The patterns they find give clues into practices from centuries ago. A high concentration of badges related to a certain saint found on a historic road may signify a previously unknown pilgrimage route. Ampulla, who regularly found at the borders of farms and fields, suggests that farmers used holy water to bless crops. We very seldom find ampulla from excavated sites in villages or towns, but we've got hundreds of these turning up in plowed fields, Gilchrist explained. They're often intact objects, but the tops have been pried off or they've been bitten off in some cases. And so the sort of theory is that these things are being used in some kind of architectural ritual. The existing record also tends to reflect what is going on in cities. Most of the finds that are recorded with us are through metal detecting, and the metal detector users, generally speaking, are searching in the countryside on arable sites and not in cities, said the British Museum's Lewis. In the countryside, people are kind of living in a different way, and those people in the countryside are likely to be less wealthy than those in the cities. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.